From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, bringing Jane Austen's Emma to the screen, we talk with director and screenwriter Douglas McGrath. He made his directorial debut with a film that has just come out on video. Also, we remember Chicago syndicated columnist Mike Royko, who died this week at the age of 64. We'll hear an interview from 1989. Rock critic Ken Tucker introduces us to electronica, a music style that's emerging as the new sound overseas. Tucker reviews the newest CD from one of that genre's biggest acts, the Chemical Brothers. And book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Ward Just's latest novel, Echo House. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. One of the armed separatists in West Texas is giving up. Jo Schweikert Moss, a spokeswoman for the Texas Department of Public Safety, says the separatist is Robert Scheit, who had been previously detained.
Mr. Scheit was the member who was arrested Sunday and then released later in exchange for the two hostages that were initially taken at the start of this activity. Mr. Scheit is currently charged with engaging in organized criminal activity, which is a first-degree felony here in Texas.
Scheit's departure leaves a dozen members of the so-called Republic of Texas holed up in the trailer home in Fort Davis. President Clinton is leading a ceremony today in Washington, D.C., dedicating a memorial to former President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The memorial tells a story about the four-term president and includes a statue of him seated by the radio. Roosevelt used radio to reassure the nation during the Great Depression. He called these conversations fireside chats. President Clinton said that when Americans become doubtful about the course of the country, they should strive to become more like Roosevelt.
My fellow Americans, every time you think of Franklin Roosevelt, put aside your doubts. Become more American. Become more like him. Be infused with his strong and active faith.
About a dozen advocates for the disabled, many in wheelchairs, gathered near the memorial to press their demand that Roosevelt's disability be depicted in the memorial. Roosevelt contracted polio in 1921 and never walked without help again. The U.S. unemployment rate fell to 4.9% in April, the lowest rate in almost a quarter century. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The sharp drop in the unemployment rate was a surprise. Most analysts had expected it to stay at 5.2%. The drop suggests continued strength in the labor market. Catherine Abraham, commissioner of the Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics, cautioned, however, that the monthly rate can fluctuate sharply and warned against reading too much into one month's drop. In fact, the other measure of the job market released today painted a weaker picture. The economy created only 142,000 non-farm payroll jobs in April. That's about the same as in March, but far fewer than economists had expected. While the low unemployment rate is evidence of a tight labor market, there was no sign in this report of wage pressure. In fact, the average hourly wage fell by 1 cent. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
Britain has its youngest prime minister in 185 years. 43-year-old Labor Party leader Tony Blair became premier today, one day after his party threw the ruling Conservative Party from office after 18 years in power. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 20.5 points at 6,996. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher in volatile trading. At noon, the Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 20 points. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are in a quandary over today's employment report. On one hand, payroll growth during April was smaller than expected, with the creation of 142,000 non-farm jobs. But in a separate survey, the unemployment rate fell to 4.9%, which is the lowest level in a quarter century. At the same time, the index of leading economic indicators rose, but it was below forecast. These reports have done little to clarify the outlook for interest rates. There is also fading optimism about an imminent balanced budget agreement after the White House said more talks are possible through next week. Among the day's winners are computer networking stocks, which have gained after Merrill Lynch raised its earnings estimate for Cisco Systems. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Justice Department is accusing the Boeing company of knowingly permitting defective parts to be installed in hundreds of Chinook military helicopters. There are two that have crashed and caused minor injuries. A lawsuit was unsealed yesterday in federal district court in Cincinnati. Boeing denies the charges. Much of the case is based on the testimony of whistleblower Brett Roby, a former quality control engineer for Speco Corporation, a Boeing subcontractor. The Secret Service and the FBI are warning lawmakers that billions of dollars are being stolen each year by high-tech thieves. Officials say the thieves use a laser scanner to capture a picture of an original check, then they use a personal computer to alter the data, and then use a high-quality laser printer. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations, and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, filling in for Terry Gross. Even though Jane Austen wrote her novels more than 150 years ago, contemporary filmmakers are discovering the cinematic possibilities in her fiction. We've seen adaptations of Sense and Sensibility, Persuasion, an offbeat modern take on Emma called Clueless, and earlier this spring, A&E presented a British version of Emma. Douglas McGrath weighed in last year with his adaptation of Emma, starring Gwyneth Paltrow in the title role. It just came out on video. Emma is a well-to-do 21-year-old who has made it her life's work to play matchmaker to the residents of her small English town. She successfully got her nanny married off and determines to do the same thing for a good friend.
She was as selfless a friend as I have ever had. And I hope to say someday I have done half as much for someone as Mrs. Weston did for me.
You must be happy that she settled so well.
Indeed. One matter of joy in this is that I made the match myself. People said Mr. Weston would never marry again, and what a triumph!
Triumph? You made a lucky guess.
Have you never known the triumph of a lucky guess? Had I not promoted Mr. Weston's visits and given encouragement where encouragement was needed, we might not have had a wedding today.
Then please, my dear, encourage no one else. Marriage is so disrupting to one's social circle.
Only one more, Papa. When Mr. Elton joined their hands today, he looked very much as if he would like the same kind office performed for him.
Problem is, Emma is a lousy matchmaker. Douglas McGrath made his directorial debut with Emma. He also wrote the screenplay. A few years back, McGrath collaborated with Woody Allen on the screenplay for Bullets Over Broadway. He's also a contributing editor to The New Republic. I asked him why he wanted to make his first movie based on Emma.
When I first read it, it reminded me of those great comedies that Hollywood used to make in the 30s and 40s. Most particularly, it reminds me of the Philadelphia Story. And it has that kind of, I mean, there are many similarities in a way. You know, both Emma and the Philadelphia Story have extremely attractive heroines who are witty and well-spoken, who are, surround themselves or live in a world full of other witty, well-spoken people, most of whom are making a complete mess of their lives. And it takes the two heroines, it takes falling in love for them to become better, more compassionate people. And it's so rare that you can go to the movies these days and see a literate comedy. And I really wanted to try to write a literate comedy. And Emma has all those ingredients.
What was it like for you then to take this novel, which you obviously connected to, and try to turn it into a screenplay? Because obviously you have to make some pretty hard choices about what you're going to keep, what you're going to discard.
Mm-hmm, that's true. That's the hardest part in a way, is allowing yourself to leave something out. Because the book is so exquisitely written, you don't really want to take anything out. But, you know, you'd have a 9-hour movie if you didn't take some things out. So what I did was I made an outline. At the top of every page of the book, I would write very briefly what happened on that page. And by the end of the book, I took everything that I had written and made it into an outline, which ran to be about 40 or 50 pages. And then what you do is you just look for places where there might be repetition and where you could stand to compress some things. And eventually you get it, boiled down, for want of a more felicitous phrase, into the essence of the novel. And luckily, the way she tells the story works quite naturally for the movies. It's all spoken out loud between the characters, so you don't have to find a way to get the story across that isn't already there.
And the dialogue that we hear in the movie, is that really lifted right from the novel?
It's my policy to lift as much pre-written dialogue as possible. Every so often, I was forced to fall back on my own resources and write something of my own, but it was my policy to take as much as possible. And you would want to anyway, apart from my natural laziness, you would want to, because she's, not to trivialize it quite as much as it sounds like, but she's one of the great dialogue writers of all time.
Well, it is one of the more talky films I think I've seen in recent times, where it seems that almost every moment of the film, people are talking about something.
Well, that is true. But that's, you know, that's what they had then. They, you know, no one was going to the Cineplex, the Cineplex 5, and no one was getting a lovely show like this. And no one, I mean, you know, their opportunities for entertainment rested, apart from books, on discussion and conversation and the gossip that they had about the lives of the people in their town.
Well, there's something you said about your approaching this film, which I found really interesting, which was you wanted to play this comedy like a tragedy. And certainly when you look at the lives of these people, they spend a great amount of time worried about things as inane as a chipped teacup. Right. But how does tragedy, at least the way you wanted to deal with this film, how does tragedy enhance the comedy?
Well, you know, if you play the least little thing in there, you know, nothing tragic happens in the film. Right. But if they treat everything with the importance of tragedy, if they treat a snub at a dance or an insult at a party as if it's the most important thing in the world, that makes it more amusing to us because you see how hilariously important the most trivial thing is to them. And there's a scene in particular in which I always think of this. Harriet Smith, who is Emma's, the young woman that Emma's taken under her wing, Emma thinks to help, but as we, right. as we see, to whose lives she ruins. Harriet has been in love with Mr. Elton, this vicar, who is not in love with her. And she has saved these little mementos that have the vaguest connection to Mr. Elton, a little piece of bandage that he touched once and a pencil that he left in their house. And she keeps them in a bag called Harriet Smith's Most Precious Treasures. And she guards them and holds them with such delicacy and as if they are, you know, valuable jewels. And the fact that she so sincerely, so deeply has so much feeling for them, if she treated them lightly, it wouldn't be funny to us.
You attended a White House screening of Emma, I believe sat right next to the president.
Mm-hmm.
In doing so, is it possible to pay attention to what you put on the screen knowing that the president of the United States is sitting right next to you?
No, it's actually not possible. Luckily, I've seen the film more than 2 million times now, so I don't actually need to pay attention to it. And I was much more interested in watching him. It's amazing how you can get your eye, I never thought you could, to actually change directions, your left eye, which is on the presidential side, from where the right eye is looking. You can keep the right eye on the screen and swing that left one around. You can't pay the least bit of attention. But I might say no one else in the audience can either.
They're all watching the president too?
They watch the president watch the movie. I think it would be unfair of anyone who was at that screening to say they watched the movie. They would just have to say they watched President Clinton watch the movie because it was like, you know, there'd be a joke or something funny would happen in the movie and he would laugh and then a half second later, the rest of the audience would laugh. And if he didn't laugh, nobody laughed. But it had that weird sense of delay like on a transatlantic phone call.
Did he talk during the movie? One of my pet peeves in a movie theater.
Yes, he did, and you can't ask him to be quiet. You can't just say, shh, watch the movie. Because luckily he was talking about the movie. He actually asked questions throughout the movie, which was nice. My mother, who talks continuously through every movie we've ever attended, felt so validated to hear that he'd spoken during the movie, because she and I now have to sign a contract before we'll go to the movies with each other, which her behavior is quite limited. But at least his questions were all about the movie. You know, he'd ask where we shot and who was playing certain parts and whether Gwyneth had worked with an accent coach. And he was really very interested in the details of it.
Douglas McGrath directed Emma, starring Gwyneth Paltrow, which is now out on video. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Douglas McGrath made his directorial debut with the film Emma, starring Gwyneth Paltrow, which is now out on video. Let's just talk a little bit about your childhood. You grew up in Texas.
I did, in Midland, Texas.
Did you show any early interest in acting and showbiz as a kid?
I did. I think anyone growing up in Midland would turn to their imagination at a fairly young age. There's not a great deal... especially if you don't really want to be involved in a dirt-related activity, there's not a great deal to do. So I was always, writing little plays and carrying on, I'm sure, in horrifying and embarrassing ways to my parents. But, from the beginning.
You attended Princeton University.
I did.
Was that a big leap out of Texas?
Well, I had gone to prep school before that in Connecticut. I'd gone to Choate, Rosemary Hall. And so that was more the big leap. That was actually quite a shock to my system because everything was different. Princeton seemed, by comparison to my years at prep school, quite easy and friendly because I'd kind of gone through all the hard stuff of leaving home and changing sides of the country at prep school. So Princeton was actually four uninterruptedly happy years. I thought it was completely delightful. And also, you know, Midland is very, let's just say, not overpopulated with trees and greens. And Princeton is quite lush and beautiful. So I was just happy. You know, I would just be happy looking at it, apart from everything else. I just thought, this is so beautiful. I can't believe it.
Well, after you graduated from Princeton, shortly after you graduated, you did get a job with Saturday Night Live. And this was the fateful season 1980 to 1981, considered perhaps the worst season in Saturday Night Live. What were you hired to do?
It seems to help ruin the show. I was hired as a writer, which was the equivalent of helping to ruin the show. It's funny because I didn't have any plan for what I was going to do when I got out of college. And I knew I wanted to be an actor or a writer or something, but I didn't know how I was going to make a living at it. And I was so paralyzed with fright about it, that about how to go about making a living and paying for an apartment and taking care of myself, that it was so unnerving to me that I just decided not to do anything and hope somehow somebody gave me a job out of pity.
And they did.
And it worked. I don't know how this happened, but the day before graduation, my old friend from Midland, Liz Welch, who now lived in New York, was working at the show, and she said, they're hiring new writers. You should send in some material, because I'd written some plays in college. And so I sent in some material, and I got hired. And I thought, oh, this is fabulous, because at that point, Jane Curtin and Gilda Radner and Bill Murray and all those great people were on the show. So I thought, hey, this is great. Little did I realize that, you know, the reason they were hiring people of my caliber is that every single writer on the show had quit. All the actors had quit. Everybody, the guy who puts the water in the water cooler had quit. There were 125 empty desks in that office, and they needed people to fill it. So I was the first writer hired, which I thought was a compliment, but then I later saw it was an omen. And, 17 others were hired. A new cast. This is when Eddie Murphy started. And he was the best of the group.
Sure.
But then there was a drop-off after that. And it was really, really a terrible year. Because of us, really. Because the writing was very, very bad that year.
So where did you go after Saturday Night Live?
to my room, back to my room. And I wrote some screenplays with, actually one screenplay with a very funny writer from the show named Terry Sweeney, which we sold on the verge of our bankruptcy to Paramount, and which was never made, but was rewritten by, I don't know if you rewrote it, but it seemed to have been rewritten by every other person in the country. And then I wrote a screenplay on my own, and the exact same thing happened. Sold it to Disney, and then they didn't make it. And then I just thought, I don't want to do this, because it was too discouraging to work that way.
Well, what I read was that after realizing that a number of screenplays that never went anywhere, and I think one called Born Yesterday, which was pretty much a failure, that you went back to fiction, went back to reading, and decided perhaps in order to learn this craft, I have to go back to the masters and figure out how to tell a good story.
Yeah, well, the reading is the best thing. It wasn't quite as conscious as that, but reading was the best thing. Reading great books was the best thing I could have ever done, because the quality of the writing in those books is so great at every level. It's not just good narrative, and it's not just good characters. It's also good dialogue. It's also poetic. The classics are classics because they're really great at every level. And I think one of the risks for screenwriters today, or one of the mistakes young screenwriters make, is that they study other movies. And that's why you feel when you go to a movie so often these days, it just feels like other movies. It feels derivative of things that aren't particularly meaningful to the writer. And I found that in reading great books, you learn so many things that are helpful in a movie, like how to make a character distinctive and interesting. If you look at Emma, for instance, most movies that come out today might, the lead might be attractive, the co-star might be attractive, possibly there's one supporting part. You might have three parts that are interesting. But in Emma, Austin writes easily five great characters, possibly six, seven, eight great characters. And that's such a great thing to learn as a writer. And you look at great literature, that's true in all the books. Not to mention the narrative strength that they bring.
Douglas McGrath made his directorial debut with the film Emma, now out on video. He's also a contributing editor to The New Republic. The new pop music buzzword right now is electronica, which a good part of the American music industry is hoping will prove to be the next big thing. Primarily instrumental music based on samples and tape loops, electronica is popular overseas. One of the most respected and highly praised electronica groups is the Chemical Brothers from England. They've just released a new CD called Dig Your Own Hole. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Chemical Brothers are one of the more anonymous acts around. They don't have a shaved, bald, angry male lead singer or a platinum blonde, angry female singer like every other pop group seems to have these days. In fact, the Chemical Brothers aren't into image at all. They barely show up in their own videos. They aren't even brothers. Tom Rowlands and Ed Simons are a couple of guys who met in a medieval history class at Manchester University. They found that they liked dance music and hip-hop a lot, that they weren't musicians, but they wanted to make music. So they got some computers and did. Among the many things the Chemical Brothers do to create their music is to feed instrumental riffs and vocal phrases from other records into a computer. They then take their bits and pieces and arrange them this way and that. It's the electronic way of cutting and pasting, of making a collage the way visual artists have long done. One cut on Dig Your Own Hole, Electrobank, has 300 different samples. What distinguishes the Chemical Brothers from most of their electronica colleagues is that they underpin their collages with strong rhythms. Their stuff isn't music to trance out to, it's music to hone in on. So far, their biggest hit is Setting Sun, a variation on the Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows that went to number one in England. The brothers have a rare flesh-and-blood in-the-studio singer on this cut, Noel Gallagher of Oasis, to supply a different sort of noise for them to play around with. The problem with the vast majority of electronica is that it's cold, sterile stuff, music almost entirely lacking in spiritedness and sensuality. That's one big reason why the Chemical Brothers' compositions are so welcome and heartening. These guys love funk music not only for its attitude and its formal daring, but also for its sheer funkiness. The brothers aren't sober-sided technocrats. They don't seem the least bit interested in using their electronica to summon up futuristic landscapes. They're in it for the pleasure of the here and now.
Ken Tucker is a critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the Chemical Brothers' latest CD, Dig Your Own Hole. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.
Back with another one of those block-rocking beats.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Chicago syndicated columnist Mike Royko, who died this week. His columns were published in more than 800 papers nationwide. We'll hear an interview with Royko from 1989. Also, book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Ward Just's new novel, Echo House. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Mike Royko, one of the most popular and enduring newspaper columnists, died this week at the age of 64, a week after undergoing surgery for an aneurysm. For almost 30 years, he wrote about his hometown, Chicago, and gained a reputation for his affectionate portrayals of so-called working stiffs and for his biting commentaries about Chicago's public officials. His column was syndicated in nearly 800 papers across the country, and Royko won many awards, including a Pulitzer Prize in 1972. Terry Gross spoke with Mike Royko in 1989, when a collection of his columns called Dr. Kooky, You're Right was published. He told Terry about an incident, which he detailed in a column, when a teenage boy started to wash the windshield of his car, hoping to get a buck in exchange. Royko turned on the wipers to get rid of the boy and drove off in anger. But later he became angry with himself because he realized the teenager needed the money.
I make a point of giving money to all panhandlers. I think by the time anybody's a panhandler, for one thing, the overhead is high. I don't like to give to charities where I read reports and find out they've spent 80% on administration. And the rest goes to the poor. The one thing about a bum, if you give a bum a buck, there's no overhead. I mean, he gets the buck.
So you give money to everybody who asked you for it?
Yeah, I've never turned a panhandler down. I don't believe in it. Because, as I say, whether the guy's problem is that he's a drunk, or that he's got a drug problem, or that he's mentally addled in one way or another, or he's given up on life, The only problem with that is you can't get a tax write-off.
How much change do you carry with you?
I don't give change.
You give dollars?
Yeah.
So you always carry a wad of singles?
Well, it's a good idea to carry a wad of money in a city like Chicago. Because if you're robbed and say you only have $3 on you, anybody goes to the trouble of investing in a gun and going into a line of work where you can go to prison, is going to be disappointed if all he gets is a handful of quarters. So I generally carry quite a bit of money on me, so in different parts, pockets and wallets, so that I can, if I have been robbed, and I think that if they hadn't been pleased that they were showing a profit for their effort, they might have shot me. So it's a really a minor investment. Giving a guy 50 or 100 bucks to avoid getting shot.
So you've been robbed a couple of times, and did you have money with you both those times?
Oh, yeah, because I follow that rule. I learned that a long time ago.
Would you ever tell a mugger who you are? You know, on the odd chance that maybe they read your column and like it?
No, I'm not a name dropper, no. Mm-hmm. No.
I wonder what kind of reaction you get.
I can give him my card. Actually, that happened in Chicago. Studs Terkel was mugged in front of his house, and the guy started wrestling with Studs. I guess Studs tried to talk to him, and the guy started wrestling with him, and they wound up on the ground. And while they were wrestling around, Studs told him who he was, and the guy said, "I've heard of you. You're a writer and a well-known personality and all that." And Studs, "That's right." And so they had a talk, but the guy still robbed him. And, but being Studs, who's a compulsive interviewer, he did get a good interview out of it. He discussed things, as they were rolling around, he discussed things with the guy.
With his tape machine on?
No, he did it, he didn't have a tape. The guy would have stolen his tape machine.
That's right. How do you think the tone of your columns has changed over the years?
The tone hasn't really changed, I don't think. I think the subject matter has changed considerably. When I first began my column, I stuck basically with local Chicago Midwest issues, primarily Chicago issues. Chicago politics was a great deal more fun then. And Richard J. Daley was mayor. In the 60s were... It was easy to write a local column in Chicago. We had most of the things that were the great social issues of the day that they were babbling about in Washington were happening in Chicago. the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, every major or minor social revolution was occurring here, and most of the problems that people talked about then were here. So by writing a local column, I was actually writing, without realizing it, a national-type column, except I was at the source or at the base of the problem rather than in Washington where people put things in the Congressional Record. But as the years went on, it would have been impossible for me to just write about Chicago happenings and Chicago politics. And so the only change has been that I've broadened the base of the things I write about.
Columnist Mike Royko is my guest. He has a new collection of columns called Dr. Kooky, You're Right. You've lived in Chicago all your life. Would you describe the neighborhood you grew up in?
Well, it was, I would say it was probably what you call an ethnic neighborhood. It was probably about 60% Eastern European, then a mixture of Irish and Scandinavians. It was a blue-collar neighborhood. We had a lawyer, a neighborhood lawyer, and a neighborhood doctor, and a neighborhood this and that. They didn't live right in the neighborhood. They went home a mile or two away to a fancier neighborhood when the day was over. But it was basically a neighborhood where people sat on their front porches at night and had a couple firemen, a copper, and two or three taverns on the block, and a neighborhood school. It was all things considered, a fairly stable neighborhood. There wasn't much crime. There wasn't a lot of money. We were at the tail end of the Depression, and then we came out, and then we had World War II. So it wasn't a real prosperous neighborhood. Most people didn't, the majority of people didn't own a car.
I've seen your father referred to as a tavern tycoon. What kinds of bars did he run?
Well, he had a tavern, and over the years, that's where he had a tavern. It was really basically his first tavern. Later, he sold that and bought taverns in other parts of the city, trying to, you know, get a bigger and more profitable place. But that was where I grew up. Was where he had his first tavern.
So your father ran one of the bars in the neighborhood?
Yeah, he had the most popular bar in the neighborhood.
How old were you when you started hanging out there?
Well, I didn't hang out so much as I swept the floor.
Right, right.
Well, we lived above the tavern.
Oh.
You always did that. I mean, that, you didn't have absentee tavern owners. Most taverns came with a flat in the back or a flat upstairs, so you lived there. So that was really just the first floor of my home. It's where the music came from. It's kind of nice. Developed a pretty good taste for Glenn Miller and the big bands of the era, because unlike most kids had to listen to a little radio, I had a great big jukebox downstairs.
Right. Did people treat you really well there, all the patrons of the tavern, since you were the son of the owner?
Well, they had to, because I tended bar. I started tending bar when I was 12 or 13, so that was due to, in those days, taverns had very friendly relations with the police. You had local police stations, and every Saturday, the bag man, the captain's man, would come around, and I'd give him an envelope, and that assured us that if there was a fight in the tavern, they'd respond quickly, and the fact that I was only 13, they would accept my father's word that I was an elderly midget and could tend bar. I was treated well. I was more generous than my father when it came to giving them free drinks. So they liked me and the customers.
Say, how much money was in that envelope?
I never looked. It was sealed. That was a matter between my father and the local police commander, although he told me years ago, years later, one of the newspapers in Chicago opened a tavern. They had an investigative reporters open a tavern and just wait to see what happens when you own a tavern in Chicago. And pretty soon people came in, building inspectors and the police and different parts of the local government seeking bribes of one kind or another. And my father was amazed when he read this story at how inflation hadn't really had that great an impact on bribes, because he told me that in the 40s he was paying more than that. And so since I didn't work on the paper that did this expose, I did a piece saying that the main thing we've seen is that the people who take bribes in Chicago are kind of dumb. They haven't really kept up with inflation.
That's syndicated columnist Mike Royko talking with Terry Gross from a 1989 interview. Royko died this week at the age of 64. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1989 interview with syndicated columnist Mike Royko.
Now, your father took bets on horses, and didn't you have to run some of the money to, to a bookie?
Well, my father, the fact that he took bets made him a bookie. Anybody who takes
But you had to run into a mafia bookie, though, didn't
well,
you?
Well, yeah, because at a certain point, if you're just a small... if you're a tavern and you take bets on horses or other sporting events from customers, there's a point of danger when you can't cover a large bet, or you can't cover if there's a lot of heavy betting on some event, and should you lose, you don't have the capital. And in those days, my father, today he could probably just go and go to the junk bond people and borrow several million dollars and cover it. But in those days, if you couldn't pay off, you'd have trouble. You know, like your legs might get broken. So. It was a routine. You would go to the big bookie. You weren't operating without the big bookie's permission in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would just take the overflow or the big bets and lay them off with the big guy, because he could cover them. And it was his responsibility, since you were also paying him a fee, a franchise fee, in effect, to stay in business.
So
really does sound like basic American businesses today. You know, for your bookies were franchised, and you go to the guy with them, and instead of going to Wall Street for the extra dough, you go to a syndicate guy down the street who is probably just as honest.
Well, did you or your father though ever get into any trouble with the mafia?
Oh no, 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 no! My father used to go to the Kentucky Derby for a year with these people. They were nice people. Most of them are. They rarely get involved in violence. That really they try to avoid that. They're not like the modern, Scarface, Al Pacino type criminals who go around shooting up the joint at the drop of an insult. Nor are they glamorous, operatic-type figures, as in Coppola's movies, The Godfather Saga. But they're just ordinary thugs who are just making a living.
Do you think it's helped you as a columnist to have grown up around a tavern?
Well, it helped me as a Chicago columnist, I think, to have grown up in Chicago. When I wrote a... 1971, I published a book on sort of an unauthorized biography, or really not a biography, just sort of a subjective view of Richard J. Daley and the city and the political machine. And when people asked me when I started researching the book, I said, yeah, I probably started research about when I was 7 or 8 years old, when I started understanding how things worked in the city. And I was well into my research by the time I was handing the sergeant the envelope. And yeah, if you grew up in a town, it helps a lot when you write, if you're going to write about it.
Were there columns that you wrote early on that got you into trouble with City Hall, that really aggravated the people in City Hall early on in your career?
Oh, well, yeah. When Richard J. Daley was mayor of Chicago, I was probably his major adversary, which showed what a cushy deal he had. I was better known than the people who ran against him, and I gave him more grief than the people who ran against him. And but someone had to do it, and he was fun. He was fun to write about. The machines. See, the papers had never really covered, as far as I was concerned, the real politics in Chicago, and the they had never described the people in politics in Chicago the way they should have been. And I started going to city council meetings and taking recorders with me, and then I would print exactly what aldermen said, and people would say to me, "My God, that was a great expose," just quoting them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started going to Mayor Daley's press conferences and doing the same thing, and quoting him precisely. And that was fun for a while. I did a number of columns, but then the press secretary said that if I didn't stop, he'd stop holding press conferences. So the press corps in City Hall pleaded with me, "Go away, or we will be cut off from the source of information." But I kind of pioneered the realism of Chicago politics, and I recall with some relish in 1968, a week before the convention, I wrote a column about what the Democrats could expect when they came to Chicago in 1968. What kind of Guy Daley was and what the machine was like. And I believe it was the L.A. Times, which got my column over our wire at the time, rejected. They didn't want to print that. Instead, they got a guy in Chicago, a college professor, to write a piece on Daley. And it was a very laudatory piece on how he was misunderstood, et cetera, et cetera. And after the L.A. Times stopped paying the hospital bills for all the reporters who got whacked on the head that they had here, after the convention, one of the editors told me, he says, "I think we made a mistake. I think maybe we should have printed your piece instead." People didn't understand Chicago politics. Even a lot of Chicagoans didn't. So if I made any contribution with my column in Chicago, that was about it.
Of all the columns you've written over the years, can you single out any one of them as having the most impact?
Oh, gosh, no. No, I can't. I really, but that's not why I do a column. I do columns because I think that at some point in the newspaper, somebody should be able to stop, take a breather, and get a laugh. And that's basically what I try to do with my columns. I don't try to take things... Even when I try to take things seriously, I try to write them in such a way that the reader will go away with at least having laughed once or twice.
Columnist Mike Royko talking with Terry Gross in 1989. Royko died this week at the age of 64. Here's Tony Bennett with the Count Basie Orchestra singing about Royko's hometown.
Toddling town, Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. Bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago,
the town that Marty Fay could not shut down. On State Street, that great street, I just want to say, they do things that they don't do on Broadway. Say, they have the time of their life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago, hometown.
Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews Echo House. This is Fresh Air. Just has been called the Washington novelist's Washington novelist. In Echo House, his 12th novel, Just enters the shadow world of invisible power brokers, people he calls fixers without portfolios who run Washington. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
The summer before my senior year in high school, I took a creative writing workshop at the New School in New York. I remember sitting around with my fellow students, reading aloud our ornately symbolic stories about suicide and young love. The instructor, a published short story writer, ominously told us on the first day of class that she supported herself by writing game show questions for Jeopardy. Her understandably gloomy worldview was reflected in the Johnny OneNote reading list of great fiction she assigned us. James Joyce's The Dead, Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, and Sherwood Anderson's Death in the Woods. Ever since, the memory of that class has frightened me away from teaching any creative writing courses myself. But if I were foolhardy enough to do so, I'd assign my students the first 60 or so pages of Ward Just's new novel, Echo House, as an exemplar of well-crafted storytelling. Echo House is a saga about the lives of three generations of men in the powerful Bell family of Washington, D.C. The novel opens on a convention night early in this century. Senator Adolph Bell has been promised the Democratic vice presidential nomination, and his family and cronies are gathered in the family mansion named Echo House to await the fateful phone call. But when the phone rings, it conveys a message of betrayal. In a heartbeat, Adolph changes from political patriarch to pariah. His mortified young son, Axel, resolves never to lust after the second best like his father, but to aim for the presidency. Flash forward to World War II. Axel and a buddy are working for the OSS in France. On their way to join Patton's army, they detour their jeep through a remote valley where they find a brigadoon-like village seemingly untouched by the war. The two Americans are welcomed by the locals and fed it that night in a nearby chateau. The catch is that we readers already know from the novel's prologue that Axel will be horribly wounded in the war. So as Axel sips cognac, we wait in racking suspense for the poison to take effect, for the knife to be plunged in his back, for the instrument of destruction destined to ruin Axel's presidential hopes to make its appearance. In a virtuoso demonstration of controlled author sadism, Just lets his readers cry uncle for about 30 pages before he delivers the dreaded blow. Just takes his tale about the Bell family through the Cold War, the Camelot years, when Axel's son Alec begins working as a lawyer, and the Nixon, Reagan, and Clinton administrations. An old pro at capturing the inside the Beltway scene just depicts a Washington populated by power brokers and an unelected elite that includes Axel and Alec Bell, who are active members of the intelligence community, a pair of father-son bureaucratic spooks. But the lives of bureaucrats, even those affiliated with the CIA, do not inherently make interesting reading. After those breathtaking first few chapters, Echo House dwindles into a much weaker chronicle of secretive, high-level paper shufflers with lousy marriages. Everyone here, the Bells, their wives, and mistresses, are so deadpan and enigmatic, they always seem to be talking in code even when they're cooking dinner. In a set piece on the opening page of the novel, Just describes the layout of the Bells' Echo House. It unfortunately could serve as a plot diagram for his novel. Just explains, the name of the house derived from the repetition of rooms on the first floor, each room perfectly square but diminishing in size. Chapter by chapter, Echo House the novel also shrinks until it and my interest reached a vanishing point.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Ward Just's new novel, Echo House. Fresh Air was produced today by Roberta Shorrock and Joan Tui Westman. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth and Lauren Krenzel. Alan Tu directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Tomorrow is the birthday of James Brown. He'll be 69. Here he is with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why marriages succeed or fail. We'll talk with psychologist John Gottman, who has studied what behaviors are key to a successful marriage. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.